Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Swim podcast.
All right, how's it going? Welcome to Swim Podcast episode 4. My guest on this one is Scott Ian of Anthrax. And whilst he was over recently in London, he was doing like promo stuff basically for the new Anthrax album For All Kings. But as I'd interviewed him about a week before, maybe 2 weeks before on my show on Radio 1, I felt like we'd probably just be going over the same ground. I didn't really want to do that. And I asked if he was cool if we could do the podcast and talk about other stuff other than the album. And we do go into it a little bit at the end with regards to like the video that they put up online recently. But that was in relation to other stuff we were talking about. I hope you enjoy it. I really enjoyed listening back to it, actually, whilst I was just checking through things and getting all the levels right, which I hope I've done because there was a few comments last time that it needed to be a bit louder. So hopefully, you know, I'm still finding my feet with this and working it out. So if you have any comments, hit me up on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Daniel P. Carter or at Swim Podcast, either of those. This is Scott Ian. Check it out. So it's always awkward for that first moment to get the ball rolling, as it were. But I was thinking about this, and there's a couple of things that I hold really close to my heart about Anthrax. And the first thing was the first ever big show I went to was you guys at Hammersmith Odeon. It was actually on my birthday as well. It was when you had Testament was supporting, so it was when the
Among the Living,
yeah, and it was when the I think you filmed the video there,
yeah.
So that's always been, that was my whole introduction into that world, which was an amazing thing,
cool,
which I hold very dear. And then the second thing was, which is weird, was an old band that I did with some buddies a while ago ended up using a sample at the start of the record, and it was from when you took Kirk Hammett to CB's,
yeah,
to see Crumbsuckers.
Uh-huh.
And you know that audio's, yeah, online where they, yeah, they get him up to play Hub Run,
right?
And I think it was like
Tommy Carroll,
yeah,
yells, I can't remember what he said, but he yells something about Kirk can get off the stage or something,
yeah, yeah. And then Billy set him straight, as I recall in the audio.
Oh, really?
Billy Milano's like, that's what you get for being a dick, Tommy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So that's...
I was there.
Yeah.
I remember it. I mean, I remember it happening. I don't remember the exact details, but...
I think that's a...
Crazy.
I think that's a good... That's one thing that I'd like to talk about, that whole sort of... That whole point in history, because I think something that we take for granted now is that, you know, even... You know, people listen to everything now, and mm-hmm. I think your band had a big part in obviously with Bring the Noise. That was a big deal. But when you go back even further, and I've, like, you know, you read about some of the stuff about those sort of matinees that were happening at CB's when the New York hardcore scene was coming through.
Mm-hmm.
It was really two distinct groups, wasn't it? Like you had CB's, and it would be all the punk kids and the skinheads and the hardcore kids. And then you had, was it L'Amour in Brooklyn?
Uh-huh.
Which was where all the metal shows were, right?
Yep.
But it was weird that people didn't feel they could go to both. Because if you turned up, I remember reading some stuff, like if you turned up to those shows and you had long hair.
Yeah, there was no crossover back then at all. I didn't even know about. I think, look, I had obviously heard about early punk rock because I was a Ramones fan, but they had already, even in the late 70s, they had already kind of transcended punk. I mean, I saw them on TV on the Sha Na Na TV special. If you remember who they were like a 50s cover band kind of thing. They had their own TV show back home then, and I saw the Ramones on that show. And then it wasn't long after that I found out the Ramones were from Queens, not far from where I was living growing up as a kid. I was 15 years old. And then I saw him play Queens College around 79 or something like that. So, but, and I, of course, I knew who the Sex Pistols were, but it wasn't my thing. I was a hard rock and a metal kid. I had long hair. So it wasn't until 82, it would have been 82, I think. I went with Neil Turbin, the first singer of Anthrax. He was more connected to Manhattan than Danny Lilker or I was. We were much more Queens kids. We'd go into the city, but like Neil hung out in the city. And so I went with him to see, I think it might have been Danny was there too. We went to see The Exploited at a club called Great Gildersleeves, which is kind of one of the forgotten New York City downtown clubs. It was only one block north of CBGB's downtown. And also tons of hardcore and punk shows back in the day, but it doesn't really ever get talked about. Like, people always remember CBGBs for obvious reasons. But anyway, we went to the Exploited show, and we sat in this tiny little, you can't even call it a balcony. It was like two rows of seats above the floor. And I just looked down. I couldn't believe what was going on in the crowd. You know, all these punk kids and skinheads and whatnot, slam dancing and pogoing, and there was stage diving, and I was like, oh my god, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. I gotta get down there. I was drawn to it. And Neil said, you know, you can't go down there, man, you have long hair, they'll beat the shit out of you if you go down there. And I'm like, why? He goes, they don't like metal people. Like, there's no, and he wasn't lying, it was true. At the time, there was no crossover. And so then it took, I didn't go back to another show. It was probably late 83 or early 84, where I had already gotten into New York hardcore bands at that point. I was listening to like Agnostic Front and Adrenaline OD and other stuff. And I really wanted to go to shows, Murphy's Law, but always too scared to go to CBGB's. I found out about the Sunday matinees, and I would always get, oh, you don't want to go down there, you'll get your ass beat, skinheads will beat your ass. And so, you know, I was a skinny little kid with long hair, you know, was I at the time at 18 or 19 years old. There's no way I was going to go down there. And then finally, my friend Robert and I, it was an Agnostic Front Murphy's Law show, and we're like, you know, we missed so many great shows already. Like, let's just do it. Fuck it. Let's just do it. We'll stand at the back. I'd never been in CBGB's before. I had no idea. I was like, wherever it is, we'll just stand near the door. And if it even seems like anyone's going to want to beat us up, we'll just run away. We'll just run. You know, what's the worst that can happen? We'll escape, you know? He's like, all right. Because I wasn't going to go myself. I had to have someone go with me. If I went myself, no one ever see me again. So we went down there and just kind of kept the lowest profile that we possibly could. And it was a heavy scene, man. Walking up, and there's a whole crowd of people out front. That's because everyone would go outside between the bands. You know, all punks and skinheads. I think I saw one dude with long hair, but he wasn't a metal guy by any, you know, sense of the word. He was like a guy who probably lived in Tompkins Square Park at the time. And, you know, squatting somewhere. And there was no metal dudes. We just stood at the back, and people kind of were looking at us, but nobody was like wanting to beat us up. No one was talking to us either. You know, it was very much like a scene. We just stood at the back. And at some point during that is when Billy Milano walked up to us. You know, it had to have been after Fistful of Metal. So it was early 84. That's coming together a little more in my brain now, because he came up to me and he knew I was a dude in Anthrax, so the album had to have been out at that point. So it would have been early 84. And he came up to me, and you know, and I see this guy walking towards us, and I'm like, get ready. We gotta get out of here.
Get the door.
Scary looking dude in a Psychos t-shirt, probably. Or probably was wearing an Agnostic Front skinhead shirt. And he's like, aren't you the guy in Anthrax? I'm like, uh-huh. You know, please don't kill me. And he's like, I'm Billy Milano. I play bass in the Psychos. I'm like, okay. He's like, do you want to come meet the guys in Agnostic Front? And I'm like, uh-huh. And I'm thinking, like, is he just luring us backstage so they could beat us up? But it wasn't the case at all. Everyone was super cool. But he said, no, you're right. I said to him afterwards, I thought you were going to beat me up. He's like, I'm not going to beat you up. Other people in here want to beat you up. He goes, but now you know us. So if they want to beat you up, they have to go through us. And nobody's going to fuck with us. You know, because Agnostic Front were the kings of, you know, so it's like nobody's going to fuck with them. And from that point on, that was it. Like, that was my entry into hardcore matinees. And I was there every Sunday. If I was home, which was most of 84, 85, even 86, because we weren't a touring band yet. It wasn't until like late 86 and then into 87 we started getting busy touring. But those like 84, 85, 86, I was there every Sunday practically. And man, you know, and there at the Ritz, everywhere, Gildersleeves, anywhere there was a show, Danceteria. That was, you know, I was a spectator. You know, yeah. I will never claim New York hardcore. I was not OG. Like, yeah, I was one of the first metal dudes for sure, if not the first metal dude. But, you know, that's people had already been going to shows there for 3 years before I showed up. That whole thing had started years before. I was just a fan who was lucky enough to meet some really cool people and get accepted. And that totally opened my mind to a whole other world of music, you know, which then, of course, came out through the music I was making and the t-shirts I was wearing and all of that crap. And, you know, but yeah, it was an amazing, amazing thing to get to be a part of and to witness and to be there to see some amazing shows back then. It was incredible.
Yeah. It was an incredible scene. And I think it's interesting to see that people can't even probably comprehend that that's the way it was back then, that it was like, you like this, your hair is this length, you don't come anywhere near us, and vice versa. But then it was like people from that scene then started going over to see, and then there was this weird cross pollination.
Yeah, well,
and
funnily enough, it was actually the skinheads in New York were the most open minded people at that time, even more so compared to the punks and the metal kids, because the skinheads totally, like, you know, look. More and more long hairs and metal people started showing up at CBGB's. I wasn't the only one who was intrigued by this hardcore sound and was in love with this sound, but was like kind of scared to go to shows. Slowly but surely, more and more people started taking that risk on a Sunday and realizing, hey, nobody's beating me up, you know? Like, but yeah, by 85, when the scene started to get trampled a bit by metal kids, then that's when there was more schism, because the scene was just, it was changing. Some people didn't want change, but you can't stop change.
Yeah.
But when the hardcore people started coming to metal shows, because we started inviting all our friends to come see Anthrax play, like we'd play the Ritz, and we knew that, okay, the security there for a metal show, they're not going to understand, like they're going to beat on the kids if they come over the barricade and try and stage dive and all this. So we would get, like, Jimmy from Murphy's Law and this guy, Big Charlie, he was a big scene guy back then, and a guy named John and a Wrecking Machine and Billy and all these guys, and they would bring a crew down and they would work security because they knew how to treat the kids if they were coming over the barricade.
Just to stop kids and getting whipped. And just
to handle it. Yeah, wow. Yeah, stop them. So we started inviting our hardcore friends to our shows, and they would... Not only would they work the stage, but they would also be stage diving and doing stuff. So, you know, 1,500 metal kids would be seeing, like, Jimmy from Murphy's Law stage diving at an Anthrax show going, whoa, that looks like fun. But then, you know, they come up on stage and act like idiots. So there was a learning curve, certainly, for the metal kids. And I also think there was a learning curve for the metal scene just on seeing skinheads and stuff at the shows. Because even... In the other way, it was like a reverse racism thing almost. Like, what are these skinheads doing here at our shows? You know, like skinheads showing up at Lemoore's or whatever, and, you know, metalheads thinking that, oh, they're here to beat us up. Or, it was a bit of a learning curve for everybody, I think. But the sad part about the whole thing was, like, by 85 and certainly in 86, there was so much cross-pollination. And of course, the metal scene by that point had become so much bigger than the hardcore scene. And, you know, I think it started ruining it a little bit, certainly at CBGB's, because you can only fit a couple hundred people in there. And, you know, now all of a sudden you got all these metal kids trying to get in the shows and getting in the pit and acting like assholes and just getting in there for violence sake and not actually just going in there and dancing, which is what it was really all about back then, was people, as Sick of It All says, demonstrating their style. And metalheads just turned it into a, you know, American football match down in there, just like, just insanity and violence for violence sake. And that changed. And it was okay at, for metal shows, but nobody at CBGB's wanted that to happen. So yeah, there were fights and things like that going on. And then by 86, you had metal kids who were like listening to hair bands and then would shave their head and start wearing like a Gorilla Biscuits t-shirt or, you know, whatever, whatever the most extreme thing was by that point, you know, 86. And then wanting to fight me because I had long hair and I was the guy in Anthrax and they're like trying to be cool. Meanwhile, they owned both Anthrax records. And, you know, I had like, I had a couple of these young skinhead kids like follow me home one day on the subway and, like, I had to turn around and say, all right, I can't take three of you, but one of you's getting knocked out. Let's go. And then they were like, fuck you, faggot. And then they ran away. And then I stopped going to shows kind of after that because I was like, you know, this is bullshit. I'm not going to go to CBGB's and get stabbed just so some kid who just shaved his head could say, oh, I stabbed the guy from Anthrax. Like, you know, it got weird at that point in time. So yeah, it was kind of a bummer, but I did have like a really amazing kind of 3-year window down there where it was incredible.
You're credited as taking, like I said, with taking Kirk down there. I heard that you and Charlie took James down to like a Broken Bones show.
Yeah, that was in like January of 85 because Metallica was playing 2 or 3 nights at L'Amour's and we brought James down to see Broken Bones. I think Cliff was there too.
Yeah. I think, you know, that's a huge step because you guys going down and seeing these bands and it then taking on board certain elements of what's going on with them musically, you know, I mean, thrash was a whole new revolution within that scene of music because not only was there the energy and speed and the ferocity and whatnot that you had from that scene, it cut a load of the some of the more cheesy elements that metal had and thrash came along and just kicked the table away with that. And then it became, you know, with you guys and then when Dan and John went on and did Nuclear Assault,
right.
And it became more sort of socially aware as well.
Sure.
And I mean, that was a big deal, I think.
It predates that because it was already going on the West Coast too. Like if you go back, watch the Institutionalized video from Suicidal and like you see Tom Araya in that video, you know, so there, and you know, those guys from the beginning too, were, you know, you'd always see Jeff or Dave wearing like a DRI shirt. And so it was happening on the West Coast as well. I obviously can't speak for going to the shows cause I wasn't there in 83 and 84 going to punk shows, but certainly, you know, Slayer, certainly Jeff was way into that stuff too at the same time. So yeah, we were all, you know, listening to the same stuff, whether it be West Coast stuff like DRI and Suicidal, or you had Corrosion from North Carolina, you had even predating the New York stuff. Like I was in the Discharge before I was in the Agnostic Front. I hadn't even heard of Agnostic Front yet. I was already listening to Discharge and Exploited and GBH and stuff like that, but mainly Discharge. I mean, for us, that was one of the most influential records, the Hear Nothing, See Nothing, Say Nothing record.
Yeah.
For us, man, that was like as important to us as Killers was, you know, like it was, or Ace of Spades, or that Discharge record was like everything for a while. And I know, you know, James was well into that too. And we were all listening to hardcore and punk at that time, at least certain guys in every band were, not everyone in Anthrax. Like at the time, Joey and Danny weren't listening to hardcore music. It was mostly, it was me, Charlie and Frankie were listening to it. But yeah, so all of that, certainly the British stuff and then the New York and the West Coast, stuff was definitely a big influence on the all the early thrash bands.
Yeah, I mean, that's such an exciting time that it created this whole new genre within metal. And I mean, that hasn't... I mean, that, and then the same thing didn't happen again until years later,
right,
when with the new metal thing. And again, that was because of New York bands from kind of that sort of scene, I guess, with like stuff like Helmet and Unsane and
Quicksand.
Yeah,
yeah. Course. I mean, yeah, it's funny because you know, and you can even go further back because, you know, yeah, Walter, who was in Gorilla Biscuits and then went on to form Quicksand, and then that influences a whole another scene that comes out of that, you know, like it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, yeah, it's an interesting thing, man. And then as I said, the thing with Public Enemy, which is probably another huge part of the start of the next new genre to appear in metal. Like when you think about it,
I am responsible for all.
You've done everything. You made everything.
I am responsible for all of heavy metal.
Exactly.
I'm responsible for Sabbath, because we could segue into Doctor Who. Corey and I actually have a TARDIS. We just don't tell many people. And I actually one time took the TARDIS without telling Corey, and I went to Birmingham, and I'm responsible for Tony Iommi's hand injury. I made that happen so he would then have to tune the strings down
exactly,
and create heavy metal.
Well, I, you know, we can laugh about it, but it's true enough, though, with the... I mean, the Public Enemy thing, I remember at the time, it was such a big deal. Didn't, you know, people hadn't done... I mean, okay, you can look and go, well, there was the Aerosmith Run DMC thing,
right,
but...
But it was, the difference that being was, you know... And nothing. Look, I'm a massive fan of both of those groups.
Yeah.
That was put together by Rick.
Yeah.
You know, that was his thing, and that was also a rap band covering a rock song.
Mm.
We were a metal band covering a rap song. We went the other direction, and then we took it on tour around the world, which was you know, a big difference too. Run and Aerosmith never took it any further than, you know, kind of like the novelty single, which is amazing. It's an amazing piece of music. It still stands up today, like, as one of the most important moments in rock music.
Yeah.
And would Bring the Noise have happened without that? Yes, absolutely. Because we had already done I'm the Man. We had already written I'm the Man even before, I think, Walk This Way was even done. So, you know, I put it this way. I was listening to Run DMC before Aerosmith was.
Yeah,
you know, I was buying their 12-inch singles, and then was lucky enough to know people who worked at Def Jam, and like a couple times even was like hanging out at Rick Rubin's apartment in Manhattan a million years ago, and would like go to his apartment and listen to records. So, you know, that's another scene. I was listening to that stuff the same time I was listening to hardcore, and the same time I was listening to metal. In the fall of 1981, when I started college at St. John's in Queens, I mean, on my Walkman, I was either listening to Killers or Run DMC or, you know, some kind of punk record, you know, like it, that's all I was listening to. I would just walk around campus skipping classes listening to music.
Yeah.
Till I finally dropped out. So I was listening to all of that at the same time, always. All of it moved me the same way.
Yeah. And when... How did the whole SOD thing come about? Because that was obviously, as you've said, you've mentioned Billy coming over and initially being this scary dude.
Well, I mean, it came out of our love for hardcore. It came out of boredom in the studio.
Yeah.
It came out of a whole number of things of, you know, me sitting around with a lot of free time up in Ithaca, New York, when we were making Spreading the Disease. And Joey had just joined the band, and I was done with my guitars, and I had a lot of free time on my hands, and I was in Ithaca, New York, upstate, and there's nothing to do, and I wasn't a big drinker, and so I would sit around the studio, and I started drawing this character. I started drawing these comic strips of this character who's a zombie, basically, and he hates anything living. So it was equal, you know, across the board. Anything alive, from a flower, anything. He hates it all, right? So I would draw these little, very politically incorrect comic strips and kind of hang them up around the studio out of boredom, you know, just for a laugh. And I didn't know how to make a comic book but I knew how to make an album. And so I started writing songs based around these comic strips. And after about 9 or 10 of those, these really, really stupid, short, you know, songs, just blasts of energy with maybe one riff or two riffs and just ridiculous lyrics about anything from, you know, milk to
menstruation,
racism and menstruation. Yeah, whatever, just ridiculous. And then I called Danny Loker and I said, you know, because he was as equally into hardcore as I was and Charlie was, and I said, hey man, I'm writing these crazy songs. They're all like a minute long and some even shorter. And do you want to come up to Ithaca and check this out and work on it with me? Because we still remained friends, even though he was out of Anthrax. Our relationship wasn't the same because we didn't see each other every day, but we were still friends. And he was like, yeah. He came up to Ithaca, and like a week later, we had written the rest of the record. I think it was actually Danny who actually wrote Speak English or Die, of all people. But because we were making fun of it. That's one thing. Still to this day, I had morons calling me out online recently after the whole, and I'm not going to rehash the whole Phil Anselmo thing, but on my end of it, how could you say anything about him when you're the guy behind SOD? And I'm like, if I still have to explain this now, then you are really that dumb. Like, you know, from 1985, I mean, yeah, granted, maybe people didn't read interviews back 30 years ago from then. But yeah, we were making fun of people who had that attitude. It wasn't us who had the attitude. It was about actual people who would think that way and how stupid they are. And it was this character, you know, that we created who's like, this is the worst thing. This is the worst dude ever. His name's Sergeant D. He's the worst guy ever. Like, but I guess still to this day, people somehow think that I'm a racist. I actually had a guy say, how could you call him out about white power and ask him to donate to a Jewish center? White power has nothing to do with the Jews. I'm like, see, that's why people need to be educated. But anyway, that bit of a tangent. But yeah, that's SOD came out of that, out of our love for hardcore and just wanting to express that. And we had it in us to do that. Obviously, though, coming from the metal side of things.
Yeah.
So, of course, it was going to sound more metallic than it was going to sound hardcore, you know. So the riffs were obviously more metal-sounding riffs, and the production was more metal-sounding than a hardcore record and all that. So, yeah, we just came at it from our angle and created this monster, you know, a 22-minute monster of a record with, you know, some really, really crazy heavy riffs and fast parts and ridiculous lyrics. And,
I love that record.
And yeah, I mean, I could be wrong, but it's also, I think, might be the first recorded blast beat.
Yeah.
Because I've heard, you know, people from Napalm Death and all the early grindcore stuff saying, crediting that record with the song Milk, where that was the first blast beat. And
yeah.
It's just crazy shit.
So there you go. You invented grindcore too.
I did.
Well, Charlie did.
Yeah. Actually, that was Lilker. Lilker knew, I think it was Danny who... Because I remember Danny saying, like, you think Charlie, we're writing this really fast stuff. Is he going to be able to keep up? I'm like, dude, he could play faster than we can.
Yeah.
I'm like, anything you could play on your bass, Charlie's going to go faster. Like, and that was what that song was about. Milk was like, let's just play it as fast as we can. And I think that's where that bop, 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 bop thing came out of. Just like, we need to play faster.
Yeah. And I think it's funny that it kind of comes around as well that you said that initially that record, which you piggybacked off the back of another recording essentially, right. Came about through you drawing comics.
Yeah, we piggybacked it off Spreading the Disease. Our gear was still set up, so that's why we were able to make the record in 3 days, because all we literally had to do was turn the equipment back on and do it. But yeah, it came out of, like I said, I didn't know how to get a comic published. I had no idea, like, how to even think about or start it. Like, we'll call up Marvel and say, hey, I created this really weird character. Like, no thanks. But, yeah, I figured there's plenty of crazy records out there, you know, especially in the hardcore and the punk world at the time. There were a lot of politically correct, you know, lyrics out there at the time. So I figured, well, let's just make an album of this insanity and see if people get the joke or not. because we didn't care one way or the other. It made us laugh, and that's all that mattered.
Yeah, and that's a ballsy move as well, I think. You know, like, people do it in comedy, and it's accepted. But even then, you know, it's weird how comedy, you are allowed to push those boundaries a little. You know?
Do
you know
what I'm saying? I think it is a very fine line, because I understand what you mean. I also think if, and this is not to say Danny and I were funnier than anyone else, but I think somehow we just found the magic formula on that record to do what we wanted to do and have it work. And some people are going to be offended by anything, no matter what the explanation or the context or anything. But, you know, if anyone on the planet knows Danny and I, then you know the truth, and then you know where that came from. And I think we were able to make a record called Speak English or Die that was not offensive. I mean, when it cut to 1987 and Anthrax is opening some shows for Whitesnake, right? And Rudy Sarzo is backstage wearing an SOD Speak English or Die t-shirt. And I'm like, wow, Rudy Sarzo's wearing an SOD shirt. That's crazy. So I had never met him before, and I walked up to him and I introduced myself and, you know, hey, nice to meet you. And I'm like, dude, SOD. He's like, yeah, cool shirt, right? I'm like, do you know that record? He goes, no, it's a record? And I'm like, yeah, it's actually me and Charlie from Anthrax. It's a side thing we did a couple of years ago. He's like, oh, I just liked it because I'm Cuban and it says Speak English or Die, and I thought it was hilarious. So we did something right.
Right.
There you go.
Yeah.
We got the Rudy Sarzo stamp of approval.
Well, I think it's funny that comes about as well, as I said, from you writing comics, and then you know, fast forward, you know, you're saying you did that record because you didn't know how to write comics, and then all of a sudden, or get comics published rather, and now, you know, that part, you look at your resume and it's like written comics for DC, which is crazy. I mean, how did that all come about? I mean, that's a dream, because for me, when I was a kid, right, and I was watching your band and listening to those records and a lot of the records that we've spoken about already, or rather you've spoken about already, that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to play in a thrash metal band,
right,
and I wanted to draw comics. That was it. And obviously neither of those are obtainable goals. I remember sitting at school and being told, well, what are you going to do when you leave school, because you can't do this.
Right.
No one actually gets to be in a band and do that. That's just like a weird fantasy life, and so is drawing comics. So what are you going to do? And I imagine that was kind of the same for you, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, in no uncertain terms, you know, look, my mother threw me out of the house when I told her I quit college to focus on the band. I got thrown out. I went and lived with my dad. We since made up. This is back in like 1981 or 82, but yeah, you know, but my attitude always was, as much as I was like this complete tenacious prick about it, like I just refused to ever take no for an answer no matter what. But I always had in the back of my mind, I could always go back to college, but why wouldn't I at least give this? I'm going to put all of my efforts and all of my focus into being in a band. And if it doesn't happen, I'll go back to school. I'll figure it out. Because I could always go back to school. I can't always make a band happen, and this is my chance right now. So, you know, and obviously it worked out. But because I figured I could always go be a lawyer or a dentist like my mom wanted me. I could always go do that. That's the easy way out, to be a lawyer. I'm going to take the hard route and try and be in a band.
Yeah.
Which, like you said, it's like an unobtainable goal. You know, who gets to do that? Well, exactly. Somehow I fucking made it happen. The comics thing had nothing to do with me. I was not out there proactively looking for a deal. Nothing. I got a call one day from my then manager. This is like late 2000s, I guess. But just, hey, next time you're in New York, would you want to go up and have a meeting at DC Comics? I'm like, for what? You know, I don't understand. Like, he said, I don't know, actually, but I met this editor and she's a big fan, and she'd like you to come in and have a meeting. I'm like, sure, yeah, even just to go up and see the offices, whatever, of course. So it was about a month later, I was going, because I live in California, so I was going to New York for something band-related, and I set up this meeting, and I walk in, and I'm sitting in an office with like four or five editors, and they're like, so look, we're all fans, and we read a lot of stuff that you put online, and because at the time, like, I had a blog on suicidegirls.com. I used to write a food blog, of all things, because I'd go on these crazy food adventures around the world, and not specifically food adventures, but because I travel so much,
one of the benefits,
and I like
of touring.
To eat well. So years ago, I decided I get to go to all these places, I'm going to find crazy shit to eat. And so I would write about those things when I'd be on tour and whatnot. But they're like, we write stuff you have online, and we're all fans, and you know, your lyric writing. Anyway, we think you have a point of view, and would you like to write a comic? And I literally like turned around to see if they were talking to me, because I was like, what are you talking about? You know, yeah. Like, they're like, well, we know, like, you did Sergeant D, and you know, we just feel like you have a point of view. Would you be interested in trying to take a DC character and writing a comic? I'm like, yeah, but I don't have fuck all idea. Like, I don't know how to even start. Like, I don't know how to do that. Writing a food blog is one thing, but, you know, writing a comic book, or like writing I Am the Law, that's just like writing a book report about a comic I like, you know?
Yeah.
I was writing about existing things that happened in the Judge Dredd world. I wasn't creating new scenarios for Judge Dredd. And they're like, it doesn't matter. If you're interested, just think about it, and we'll give you, you'll work with one of the editors here. And I'm like, all right, I'm definitely interested, you know? And I said, so who, what characters? And they said, anyone in the DC universe. I'm like, I can write a Batman story. They're like, well, Batman comes, there's a lot of caveats with, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, like what? Like, what if I wanted Batman to be gay? And they're like, no, you can't do that. Like, if you're Grant Morrison, you can do anything you want. And they said that. They're like, you know.
Yeah, or Alan Moore.
Right. There's certain writers have carte blanche. If they're going to do something with a character, they could do whatever they want. With me, no. Which,
can you imagine
of course,
the uproar that would
yeah,
just
I mean,
come
of
in
course. And... Yeah. You know, and I get it. I wouldn't want me to do that. So, I start like, you know, what about Superman? What about this? What about that? And finally, I just said, who's a character that I could do anything I want with? That no questions asked. I said, because right off the bat, I'm just going to have a hard time knowing I can't do something.
Yeah.
And that's just going to fuck with my head. And they said, how about Lobo? What do you think of Lobo? I'm like, yeah, you know, I kind of used to, in the 80s, like when Simon Bisley was like, I was like, I used to love Lobo. Whatever happened to Lobo? Like, yeah, you know, we've been thinking about it and trying to bring him back. And I'm like, yeah, I think I could probably do something cool with Lobo, especially if nobody's going to be looking over my shoulder. And like, you could do whatever you want. And then we just kept talking and talking. And it was at the time when Marvel Zombies was like the biggest book.
Yeah.
You know, that Marvel Zombies thing was, which was Kirkman, right? I'm like, why aren't you guys doing any zombie stuff? It's like blowing up for Marvel. And they're like, we want to, but the powers that be, like, Marvel's doing it, we can't do it.
Yeah.
And then they said, but you could have zombies in your book. You could do whatever you want because you're out of our continuity. It's just going to be a standalone. And I'm like, all right, that makes it even better. And so that's how that whole thing came to be. And I just started thinking about Lobo, and I wrote the whole story. I wrote it out like I was writing a story, you know, Act 1, 2, and 3. Hmm. I wrote it out like an actual story. And then I'm like, all right, now what do I do with it? Here's the whole story. I'm working with my editor, a guy named Ian Sattler. I'm like, okay, now what? He goes, well, now you got to like break it down in the dialogue. And Sam Keith had the story, and he was starting to send me the pages.
Yeah. His art's great.
Oh, I love it. And I would say like, well, and I would give some directions about like, well, no, I need this to happen sooner, or maybe this should be a splash page, or blah, 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 blah. But generally, Sam was on it. He didn't need my help. And I'm like, all right, now what do? I have all these changes. He goes,
if you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, now you got to break it down in a dialogue. I'm like, well, how the fuck do you do that? I've never written dialogue in my life. Hmm. And he goes, just think about what the character, you have your story, so you know what the characters are doing. Now make them say it, you know? And I'm like, all right. And man, that was actually the most frightening thing I've ever done in my life for me.
Yeah.
Like I rarely ever have had stage fright. Like this for me was like, I can't do this. It's the first time I ever thought that in my life. I can't do it. I don't know how to do this. And I kept like, all right. And I would sit down and I would stare at it for an hour, and anything I thought in my head that I was going to put into a word bubble, everything just sounded so cheesy to me. And like, oh my God, this is the worst thing ever. I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. And I kept procrastinating, and like a month went by and my editor was like, all right, you have anything? Like, what's going on? I'm like, oh, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I'm like 20 pages in. I hadn't written a word. Right. To the point where I was finally just going to, I can't do this. I was going to say, look, I wrote the story. You do the dialogue, or get another writer to take my story, and it could be story by and then whatever. But I don't know how to do this. I would break into a cold sweat every time I tried to write the dialogue because I thought it sounded so terrible.
Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because as I understand it, like, you've grown up with comics, so you know the medium. You know it inside out because you've been a huge fan.
Right.
But then to actually be put on the spot within that world.
Yeah, and I just didn't know how to do it. Like, yeah. I've written lyrics and I've written stories, but I don't know how. And it seems like it would be the simplest thing in the world to write how it's people talking to each other. One person says this, and then the other person says this. And, you know, it seems easy until I'm trying to do it, and everything sounds so terrible in my brain. And then...
Then you have to put it into context,
right?
I guess,
but it might have been actually a conversation I had with my wife Pearl, where she was just like, "Just say it how you would say it, you know. Just put yourself in their shoes. Like if you were Lobo and you were just say it how you would say it, you know. Put it in your own words. You know the story. You know what they're doing. So just say what they're supposed to say, and then somehow that opened the door for me." And like 2 hours later, I had 40 pages written out of like the 120 pages I had to write or something. And I was really into it. Like, just like, holy crap. You know, like, I think this is pretty cool. And I called my editor and I'm like, I'm ready to show you something. And I flew to New York 2 days later with like, at that point, like half the book. I think I had book one done and I had started book two.
Yeah.
And it's on these big pieces of paper, and I used little post-it notes, and I'd stick the post-it notes on and write, you know, the dialogue. So I'm this big thing I carried on the plane, like I was carrying the Holy Grail, like, oh my God, if anything happens to this. And I get to the office and I sit with him in a conference room, just me and him, and I act out the whole thing. I read all the characters and voices and everything. And, you know, it took whatever, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And he's like, dude, you fucking nailed it. He goes, I just sat here and I have like three notes. Like, he goes, you fucking nailed it. Like, this is, you really understood like the, and I'm like, wow. He goes, how did you do it? I said, it's just me. Lobo is me, except I'm not a murderer of billions of people.
Yeah.
But yeah, but it's just me. It's me. Everyone is me. And I'm just reacting how I would react. And that kind of opened the door for me. And then it became the most, from the most daunting thing to the most fun thing, was doing that. And I'm hoping I get to do it again.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, who are the people that you, I know you're a Kirby fan, obviously. Oh, I mean, of course, yeah, I mean, yeah.
Well, I grew up on, you know, I grew up from late 60s, so late 60s Marvel and DC, all the way through, I stopped seriously collecting early to mid 90s is when like I stopped going to shops once a week, but I still kept up with a lot of titles. But by the time the late 90s rolled around, I was like kind of out. Comics had kind of lost me, for whatever reasons. My life changed, everything, whatever, things changed. But but yeah, I mean, for me, my heyday is, you know, 70s Marvel and DC, and then of course the, you know, the Renaissance in the 80s with Alan Moore and Frank Miller and all, of course, all that stuff too, which is still the best comics ever written. I mean, still nothing will ever equal Watchmen or Dark Knight. Like, still, to me, those will always be those are the holy grails of comics.
I agree.
Yeah. And there's been amazing stuff since, tons and tons of amazing books. But, you know, for me to be there, like buying, I remember, like, you know, buying Watchmen issue by issue as it was coming out, you know, like, that was like the greatest thing in the world, getting those every time you got a new issue of Watchmen.
Yeah, just monthly, mind blowing, because that was a medium being changed issue by issue. You know, it was,
and still to this day, everything that's done in comics now, even now in like 2016, is all because of Alan Moore and Frank Miller.
Yeah.
All because of what they did in the 80s. Still, right now, everything goes right back to, you could, there's like a through line right to that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was literally a sea change, you know.
It was a huge renaissance for the whole genre, not only with the writing but also with the artwork as well, because I mean, obviously Kirby was, you know, untouchable, and he invented all these incredible new means of telling a story visually, but at that time, you know, you had people like Bill Sienkiewicz and Frank Miller himself, and then people like Dave McKean, who came along and just
blew the doors open.
And
people don't realize too is, because people might say, oh, whatever, you're just being old school or whatever, but I started reading comics in the late 60s all the way through religiously up until 86. So when those comics came out, it was a revolution, because the dialogue in 99% of comics up until Miller and Moore was not that. It was, you know, comics had really kind of, especially in the early 80s, really started to take a nosedive. Like, the quality was really getting bad.
Yeah.
And it, truthfully, one could argue, if it's not for Watchmen and Dark Knight, comics die.
Yeah.
Like, comics as a medium could have went away at some point, you know, if it wasn't for those books.
Yeah, I agree. I think there were these really pivotal moments, like Killing Joke and whatnot, just
incredible.
Just made people go, actually, this is a valid art form, and
it
became like vital again. And then everything since then had to live up to that to a certain degree, and it would be like, okay. And then you did Lobo, and then you did The Demon.
Well, it's not. I've written it, but it's not, I don't know what's going to happen with it. It's something that's still kind of just sitting in limbo at this point at DC.
Okay. It's obviously something you want to get out, and
I would love to.
Would you want
to
do more of it?
But when DC moved from New York to Los Angeles, a lot of people who worked at DC made the choice to not make the move, and my editor being one of them. So my book just kind of got lost at this point. I ended up meeting Brian Azzarello at Boston Comic Con last year, and we got into talking, and I told him about the book and everything, and
that's the whole thing done, right?
Well, the story's written.
Yeah.
But no, I need an artist and you know, I need pages, and then I'll break it down. I'll break the dialogue down. But I sent the story to Brian Azzarello, and obviously he has a little bit of juice up at DC. So he told me, he said, you know, I could probably make this happen. And we were texting back and forth, and he read the story, and he gave me some really amazing notes, which I couldn't. I was like, God damn it. Brian Azzarello is like giving me notes. Like, this is insane. And I'm actually working now with some of the notes he gave me to change some of the story. And I'm hoping then once I change it, when he's not so busy working on The Dark Knight now with Frank Miller, maybe he'll somehow be able to have a minute to get my little book pushed through and out somehow.
Who would you, in an ideal world, who would you get to draw it?
That's hard.
Yeah. Like, who are the people that you... See, for me, when I was, like, a kid, people like... I don't know. Like I said, Sienkiewicz and Kyle Baker was amazing as well, who used to work on The Shadow. And you know, it was London Comic Con, actually. London Super Comic Con was this weekend, just gone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I went down to that, and, like, Howard Chaykin was there, who like, you know, worked on The Shadow and stuff and did Black Kiss and whatnot. And it's weird, because a dude that was in my class at art school, and like, you know, we would sit and have these conversations, both of us were obsessed with comics, and now he's drawing BPRD for Dark Horse and stuff. Wow. and he did that Stephen King book, is it Dark Tower?
Yeah cool.
So like, he's fully gone on and doing it, and it's awesome to see. Like, first time I'd seen him in a long time, and to catch up in that world, because I feel like it's one of those worlds where I've stepped out of, and it's kind of shot past me. So to go in every now and then and see where things are now.
There's a lot of new guys.
Yeah.
When I was actually looking for artists initially, when Etrigan book was moving, all of whose names I can't remember, but I remember sending my editor like a list of like five or six names, all who I couldn't get because they're all too busy on books.
Yeah.
That's what makes it hard too with artists is, because so many guys are on books, you know, monthly books, and they're on deadline all the time, and there's just no time for them to do something that's out of continuity. It just, it would take away from their actual work. So it kind of makes it hard to find somebody really great who's not busy. That's kind of hard.
It's nuts as well, because I, you know, when you think of those things, like, as I said, when I was a kid, I was like, oh, I'd love to do that. And I saw, as I said, I saw my mate, his name's Lawrence Campbell, so big ups. And, he was telling me he had like issues of the comic, but he also had the pages there. So to actually see those and him talking me through it, and he says that, you know, it's crazy. Like, they'll send, like, Dark Horse will send, like, FedEx him a huge, like, a crate of blank pages and stuff.
Right.
And he was just telling me how he puts it all together. It's amazing.
Cool.
I've got so much respect for it, but it just seems like such a mammoth task.
Yeah, I was up at Marvel recently. I went up there to do the, Marvel has a podcast, and Charlie and I went up to do the podcast, and so they took us for a tour around the offices, and I was shocked because, like, the Marvel bullpen, you know, where all the editors work, it's this row of offices, each office being, let's say, a third the size of this room, and like, let's put it this way, imagine if this room was just as big as this square here. Like, right here where we're sitting, the
like
three of us.
Like a pool table square almost, or a bit bigger.
With three desks in there, and like the main editor and then like two assistant editors sitting in with the main editor. And they're each in each little office, those three editors will be working on like eight books. Like, it's crazy how much work they have. And like, I was like, this is it? Like, I was actually extremely underwhelmed in a weird way. Like, I expected everyone to have these giant offices with like, but it was, everything was just crammed, and like, people just like, oh my god, like, I couldn't believe the intensity of what goes on in those rooms. I'm like, this is crazy. Like, how many books are you working on, you know? Like,
yeah. And to see that now that it's become this, you know, Marvel and DC have gone beyond the bounds of that, and they're now, you know, they're running their own TV shows, that, you know, Marvel is this huge production company that's making these incredible films. Like, how do you feel? I mean, you're a huge film fan as well. I feel that I'm a nerd as well, so I can say nerd, right?
Sure, of course.
Right? So I think, how do you see, like, this world now? Because, like, I look at some of the films that are coming out, like the Marvel films, and I just think it blows my mind, because I think if I was the kid that I was when I was first reading those titles, it's
unreal.
Yeah,
you always imagine, you know, like, and even like in the 80s when superhero movies, like let's say when the first Batman, Michael Keaton, you know, like stuff like that, to finally start seeing things realized, you know, on the big screen like that. Yeah, I mean, like anything else, I love some of it, and I don't love some of it. You know, with the Marvel movies, it's weird. I actually prefer Marvel TV. I think Daredevil and Jessica Jones are better than any movie they made, because they have more of a chance to tell a story.
Yeah,
I find these days, especially in that kind of genre, whether it be sci-fi, you know, or a comic book, or fantasy adventure, or whatever, you know, something like Game of Thrones. I just think that type of medium is better served in a serialized format, because you could really take your time and tell a story. Yeah, there are some great two and a half hour comic book movies, but for me, there's more bad ones than there are good ones still. Even, you know, like for me, the Avengers, the first one, I was entertained. By far was not my favorite comic book movie. There was like 10, I could think of 10 comic book movies I liked better than the Avengers movie. Avengers 2, I hated. Like, I hated it.
Yeah.
Like, super bummed and like about the whole thing. Like, just like, what? Really? Like, this is, like, I was really bummed on that movie. But I loved, let's say, like, I just rewatched the first Iron Man because my son watched it for the first time the other night. That movie's great.
So yeah.
I watched it two nights ago. Totally holds up. Rewatched the first Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire. Not as good as first Iron Man, but still I was entertained. Yeah. Even now I could laugh at the Green Goblin mask, whereas back when that first came out, that stupid mask, oh my God, I was laughing out loud in the theater. It was so bad. But at least looking at it, I was like, wow, who thought that was a good idea?
Yeah.
But, you know, that first hour of that movie when he's learning his powers, I thought was awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
You know? So obviously, you know, some of the Nolan Batmans I loved. I loved the first Batman with Michael Keaton. I thought that was a great movie. X-Men 2 is one of my favorite comic book movies ever made. I loved X-Men First Class, too. I thought that was awesome.
I thought that was nice.
Looking forward to the new X-Men. Granted, those aren't Marvel Studios, but, you know, it's Marvel Universe. And I'm sure I'm forgetting a whole shitload. But
it's funny, though, that
Jessica Jones and Daredevil, I can't recommend them enough on Netflix.
Yeah.
Amazing. Especially, God damn it, Daredevil is just incredible. And now I'm watching Flash, too, on I'm watching that online. And that's literally like reading a comic book every episode.
Yeah, I've not watched that.
I think it's done. You have to, don't expect it to be like, it's not a Christopher Nolan, you know, it's not dark like that. This is a much more kind of upbeat, comic booky, if anything, more in my wheelhouse of 70s type of writing. It's that kind of more
kind of
like
schlocky
a,
and
it's not even, schlocky's not the right word, maybe edging on campiness and, you know, kind of villain of the week type of thing. And, you know, they're always solving a case. And, of course, there's one story running through the whole thing. But, you know, for TV, it's great. Even for TV, the effects are good. Like, all the performances are all good. The writing is good. Like, I really feel like I'm just watching a comic book every episode.
Well, it's funny that you say about the effects, obviously, because then that brings us around to Bloodworks, which is some of the stuff that you've done. Did that come about through, like, because you did, obviously, the Walking Dead stuff. Were you a big, you did the webisode and then you did the episode where, and you got killed by Carl, which is, I mean, that's a double-edged sword right there.
Yeah.
It's like, great, I'm in The Walking Dead. That's amazing.
I tried so hard.
Killed by Carl. Sucks.
I was working Greg Nicotero so hard on that, going, dude, let me bite Carl. Just run that up the ladder and let's you totally kill off Carl. In this episode, let me be, I will be the hero. I would be the best walker in the history of walkers if I'm the one that bites Carl. Let me have this, please. It would be so amazing. He's just laughing at me. He's not going to happen, by the way. But the backstory of the whole thing, and that's nothing against Chandler Riggs, the actor who plays him. He's such a perfectly wonderful human being. He doesn't write it.
Yeah.
The backstory of the whole thing is I get a call from my agent saying, hey, you're in New York? Yeah. Well, they're going to shoot a pilot for this show that AMC is going to shoot this pilot for a show that's going to be like a talk show to air after The Walking Dead. And they're asking if you'd want to be involved in that. I'm like, yeah, that sounds great. I don't know who would ever watch that show or what that even means. But yeah, I'll go check it out. And I knew the dude, Chris Hardwick, who was the other guy doing it. I've known him forever, stand-up comedian, writer guy. So we shoot this pilot in New York. And basically what it is, you know, it's like we pretend we just watched an episode of Walking Dead and now we're talking about it. And then my gig on the show was I was the field reporter where I get sent out to the set. So at the time I got sent out, you know, not right at the same time, but then I got to go to the set where Greg Nicotero was shooting these webisodes between season one and two of Walking Dead. He shot this 6-episode web series. And I got to get made up and walk and do the whole thing. So that was my, and they cut that into like a little 2-minute package. And I'm like, here's my day on the set, you know, how'd that go, Scott, and all that. And
yeah,
so we shoot this pilot episode, you know, for the, what was to become The Talking Dead. I don't know if that airs over here when you guys, probably not at home every Sunday when Walking Dead airs, right after it is The Talking Dead.
Cool.
Well, this little weird idea for a show where we're going to talk about the show we just watched is now one of the highest rated shows on TV because Walking Dead is so massive and so much of the audience just stays tuned. So sadly, my field reporter guy on the show, when they decided, yes, we're going ahead with the show, but it's just going to be Chris hosting it, nobody else. So at the time, I was like, how could I even be bummed? I don't even know what I'm losing. I'm not losing anything.
Yeah.
Who cares? I don't even know what this show is. Hmm. Of course, it's massive, and I'm like, damn it. I wish I would have been on that show. But it was about a year later or something, I get an email from Chris Hardwick saying, hey, man, because Chris started Nerdist Industries, Nerdist.com, and it's a go-to place for all things nerdy, whether it's movies, comics, gaming, whatever, everything. I think he even had a show on over here for a while in the UK on TV for a while. He had his own show here, but anyway.
Yeah.
Nerdist.com. And he said, hey, man, what do you think about doing a show like what you were going to do on Talking Dead, but it'll just be your own thing where you go like hang out on sets or hang out with effects guys and learn shit and see effects done and get killed and whatever. Like, we'll figure it out. But are you interested? I'm like, yeah, anytime I could do anything with horror, like, get into that world.
Yeah,
of course. That's not a job. That's just fun. And so that's how the whole show came together. You know, because Chris just thought, okay, you did this cool thing and no one ever got to see it, so why don't we make a show based on that idea that AMC decided they didn't want? So that's how my Bloodworks thing, you know, came together. And I've done a whole bunch of, I mean, there's like a lot of episodes now. I don't know, 20 something episodes probably. And I'm just starting a new season of them. But yeah, I got to be on Walking Dead because of this little show of mine on the web, on Nerdist, you know, and I'm friends with Greg Nicotero. And I figured, you know what? He had me on the web series. I'm just going to hit him up, see if we could do the big show. And I just said, hey, you think I could ever come be a walker on the? He's like, you could come to Atlanta anytime, dude. I'll get you made up. And I'm like, okay, I would do that. But what about bringing the show? Because I had already done a show at Nicotero where we went to K&B. We went to the shop and he let me bash zombie heads and stuff. So I was like, you know, we did the show at your shop, but what if could I bring my crew and shoot me on set? He's like, well, I can't make that call. I have to talk to all the other executive producers and it has to be okayed by the network. And like a week later, we get the call. Everyone's cool.
That's
you can
awesome.
Totally come and shoot on the set. And the publicist from AMC, the network's like, you realize nobody has ever had this access. Like, we don't give Rolling Stone or like Entertainment Weekly or the New York Times or anyone. Nobody shoots on set. Like, nobody, you know? But it was all because Greg made that happen for me. And it was just incredible. And that kind of opened a lot of doors from my little tiny web series, because then other TV productions see, wait, they did this thing with Walking Dead, the biggest show on TV in America. Yeah. Well, we want them to cover our show too, you know. And then, you know, my director, Jack, he started hearing from other shows. And so now it's like all of a sudden this season coming up, we've got like, we're trying to figure out how we're going to get it all done. Whereas before we'd be scrambling to just even get anyone to answer our phone calls. But because we got to do Walking Dead, now, you know, people are take us a little bit more seriously. And so there's some really cool, exciting, cool stuff coming up.
That's amazing. And it's funny because obviously before we started recording this, you showed me the video for Blood Eagle Wings,
yes,
which looks like you've spoken to a bunch of people that have worked on various episodes of that show, because it's really...
Well, it's my director of Bloodworks, Jack Bennett, directed the video.
Okay.
And Jerry Constantine, who does all the effects in it, was the first guy I did a show with. He was my first ever Bloodworks show where they did a cast of my head and he like chainsawed. It looks like I'm getting my head chainsawed in half. And Jerry's amazing and works on tons and tons of TV shows and movies. Too long of a list for me to mention. But yeah, Jerry Constantine, amazing, amazing effects guy. And he came down and gave us an amazing... did an amazing job and gave us an amazing deal, because we could never afford him on an Anthrax video shoot like he gets paid to do TV and movies.
Yeah.
But he's a bro and he's a metal fan, and he did some amazing stuff for us. Like you'll see in the Blood Eagle Wings video when it's released.
It's so full on. I couldn't believe it. And I mean, that's not the finished version, but it just looks... Yeah, it's definitely not safe for work.
Well, what's cool is like these days... where you don't have to worry about MTV anymore. Not exactly. That we ever did. It's not like Anthrax ever got MTV love. We would get played on Headbangers Ball, you know, or on specialty shows, you know, but now that none of that exists anymore, really, like, who cares? Why not make the videos you want to make and do something, you know, that fits the song? And this video is the exact concept. I was in this very hotel that I'm sitting in right now back last June of 2015 with insane writer's block. I was over here to host the Metal Hammer Golden Gods, and I had 4 days off. I came over early with the specific intention of I got 4 days to work on lyrics, because when I'm at home with my son, I don't want to get anything done. I just want to hang out with my son and my wife. And I came over here early to have 4 days of just, I'm going to be by myself in London and I'm going to write.
Get shit done.
And after I got a little bit of shit done, and then I couldn't get anything done. And again, I'm talking to my wife. She goes, get out of your room. Go for a walk. Get out. And I've been to London a billion times. I love this city. So I'm like, all right. And I just start walking around from here. And I ended up down by the tower. Like, I walk for hours, just walking, meandering, just brain, just... And I got into this idea of, you know, the bones, the blood and bones that any modern city that's been around for millennia, what these cities are actually built on.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about it, when you think about... that, you know, and I just had this idea, you know, of like, it's all of the blood and bones buried underneath this city that enables this city to fly in a sense. And then I had just recently seen an episode of Hannibal where they talk about Blood Eagle Wings. And that was the first time I had ever heard of that. I never even heard. I was like, how am I at 51 first hearing about this? Oh my God. Like, that's the fucking sickest thing I've ever heard, right?
Yeah.
So somehow that concept of Blood Eagle Wings tied in with this idea of the murder of millions of innocents in the name of whatever, whether it's London or Paris or Rome or New York or Los Angeles or anywhere in the world, any great city, what that city is truly built on. And it all just tied together in my head. I came back to the hotel and was like, you know, just... got that song out of me, and I called Pearl. I was like, wow, yeah, you told me to go for a walk. Holy shit, what an intense walk I just had. Like, I get millions of ghosts in London just like following me around. So I explained that whole concept to Jack, and then he took that, my lyrical concept, and turned it into this masterpiece of a 8-minute movie you're gonna see soon.
Yeah, it's amazing, and I think it sums up that whole thing perfectly. The ending is incredible, especially.
But, yeah, it pays off. Yeah, you have to stay with it.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we've done an hour.
Cool.
Which has flown, but it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, right on. Pat, it's like no time at all. One.
Right. Cool. Thank you, man.
Cheers. I love doing podcasts. I did, you know who Mark Maron is?
Yeah.
You know, the WTF. I talked with him in January, and it comes out this coming week. They held it for album release week.
Amazing.
And that was I've known Mark forever, like since the late 90s, like, you know, Largo comedy days in L.A., and we've known each other forever, and then Brendan Small does this once-a-month thing called Baked in L.A. where it's comedy and music, and I've done both with him. I've played guitar, and I've done stand-up, and Mark's on a lot of the shows too because he does stand up too, and he's a really good guitar player, and he's like, I gotta get you on the show one of these days. And I was really excited because besides Mark being great, it's like the biggest podcast back home anyway.
Yeah.
So I can't wait for that to come out, and the conversation was really good. I actually got him to tear up.
It's like an achievement. Yeah, I feel like I've been talking about doing it for like a year and a half or something, and it's, you know, I listen to Rogan and I listen to Duncan. Do you listen to Duncan Trussell?
I don't listen to anyone's. I don't have time. I have hard enough time watching the TV shows I want to watch or reading the books I want to read. Or,
yeah.
You know, it's just...
I find when I'm... I listen when I'm driving. But, yeah, I like the format that is like voyeuristically sitting in on conversations.
Right. I think I'm going to do Rogan's
that
soon.
That would be sick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We know him from... when we were on a TV show, News Radio, that he was on in the mid-90s with like Phil Hartman, and I don't know if that was ever on here or anything, but it was a TV show in the mid-90s about our news radio station. Lots of people went on the like big acting careers from that show. Of course, Phil Hartman, you know, The Simpsons and Saturday Night Live, who was murdered by his wife. But me, John Bush, and Frankie got to play ourselves on an episode where one of the main character decides she's had enough of doing news radio and gets a job at MTV. And her first interview is with Anthrax, and she totally fucks it up. Like, she pronounces Pantera, Pantera, and like, we just totally rip on her for that. And Joe Rogan was on that show. He was one of the main characters on the show. And so we like, met that guy way back when, way before MMA or any of that stuff.
What a trip though, man, to be getting to do all these things.
Yeah,
like
the longer you stay around, the more weird things happen. Yeah, I mean, it's especially when you put yourself out there. You know, I'll let it be known. You know, people know, they see that I do other stuff. So once in a while, like, you know, these weird doors open. Now I just hope I can meet Stephen King. That's like the last thing. I just want to meet that dude.
Gonna
try and get him the right liner notes for my next book. I'm working on book two right now.
What's it about?
It's about me. it's actually more just, it's gonna be stories. It's gonna be crazy rock stories. Well, that's not even the right way to put it. You know, I hate the cliche of it's crazy tour stories. You know, because it is, but at the same time, it's more than that. It's. I had still a list of like probably 20 really, really amazing tales that just aren't even in my autobiography because contextually and just things just didn't fit.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have been able to spend enough time when you're telling that tale to take like a left turn. So I just kept a list of things that I knew. And then I started writing those stories out and I sent them to my editor and I said, what do you think for book two? And they greenlit it immediately. So, because I've got some fucking killer stories that people don't know. And they're like outside the realm of just like that. It's mostly not metal stuff. That's the thing. It's not pigeonholed into just us hanging out with Exodus and trashing a dressing room. Who cares? Like, who cares?
Yeah.
You know, there's just a lot of just killer stories.
Yeah, man. I think that it's a beautiful thing to be in the position to do something that you've always loved to do and always, you know, as a kid look at and think will be, as I said at the start, a thing that just seems unattainable. When you look at, you know, when I was looking at Maiden and stuff, I never thought I'd get to do some of the things that I've done, but it's an incredible thing, and everything that comes off of that blows my mind.
I think people want these kind of stories too, you know,
when
people
I love
these
it.
Rock books, it's what they want the most. So I got to tell the life story with a lot of really cool tales in it, but there's so much, like, so much not in that book, because we couldn't have an 800 page. Like, if it was up to me, my book would have been like 800 pages, and 300 of them would have been photos too. Like,
yeah,
when I first submitted the photos for the book, nobody told me what to do. So, you know, I need photos from like birth till where the book ends in 2011. So I must have submitted 400 pictures with captions for everyone. Took me like a week and a half editing down to that much even.
Yeah.
You know, which I really felt told the tale through the book. So if you're reading the book and then you get to the photo pages, oh, here's what he was talking about, this and this and this and this and this. It was like 400 photos all captioned. And my editor's like, this is fucking amazing. Usually you have to like pull teeth to get people to even do anything. He goes, the problem is, normally a book's going to have 16 photo pages.
Yeah.
Right. He goes, that's it. He goes, this is about, 128 photo pages. Do you know how expensive your book? You're not doing a photo book. Your book would be $100 if we did, and it has to stay under $29 or something, you know, yeah, the production costs. And I'm like, oh, all right. I'm like, well, how many do I got to get it down to? He goes, I don't know, 30 or 40. I'm like, are you fucking, no, there's no way. There's no way. I said, I'm telling you right now, it's impossible. I cancel the fucking, I'm not doing the book.
Yeah, how do you edit that down yourself? This is so important to me.
I got it down to, we went through like three edits, and I got it down to whatever it is now, which is about 90 something, just under 100.
Yeah.
Photos, I think, maybe, that are in there, and even that was more than they wanted, and the book price jumped $3 or something based on that. But it was like unbelievably difficult for me to do that.
Oh man, I look forward to the second one. I love that.
I don't even give a fuck, change my words, change the story, I gotta have these pictures in here. People want photos.
I think one of my favorite ever things that happened when I was recording, I did an album with Terry Date, and as we were coming to the end of tracking, and vocals were getting done, I was sat in the lounge, and I had one of those moments. I was like, I'm making an album with this guy that's made albums for all these incredible artists that I grew up listening to, and he's
another one we almost worked with.
Sweetheart, man. But yeah, and I was listening to all this different stuff, and he walked in to get a beer out of the fridge, and he stopped and he went, I've not heard this in ages. I think I was listening to Handsome at that point, and he was like, I've not heard this in ages. So he came and sat down and he cracked his beer,
right,
and we listened to the song, and then he told me an incredible story about when they made the album. And I went, I'll be honest with you, I was in a certain mindset, and I was like, I'll be honest with you, man, I've been listening to a bunch of your different albums, and I'm having kind of a moment. And he was like, what else have you been listening to? And I was like, I was listening to Pantera. And he was like, put it on. So I put on a song, and then he'd tell me this amazing story about when they were tracking and like even in pre-production. And then we'd finish that, and I'd be like, and he'd go, what else? And I'd be like, I listened to this Deftones. And awesome. That is one of the most incredible moments I've ever had in music. I love those stories, man. You should
get him on your podcast.
I should do. But I don't know that he'd necessarily want to talk about half those things.
That's true.
Exactly.
That's the problem.
That is the problem.
A lot of people is they can't tell their story till after they retire. I know plenty of people who are going to put out the best books for our generation. People are going to put out some of the best books ever once they're done touring.
Yeah, it's true.
When you can really tell the stories.
Well, you have to wait for people to die as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Thank you again.
Oh, you're welcome.
Nice.
That was fun.
Yeah, man. Right, that was awesome. Thank you to Scott Ian for doing that. As you can hear, it actually wrapped up, but then and then we started kind of talking about podcasts and books and stories again. So I thought I'd leave that in actually, because it was cool. You can find Scott online. His website is scott-ian.com. On Twitter, he's scott_ian. The new Anthrax album, For All Kings, is out now.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I just, you know, like I said, when I went back through it just to check all the levels and everything, it was a real good one, I thought. Next episode is with John Baisley of Baroness, and we essentially spoke about his artwork, as he's an incredible painter. And we spoke mainly about that. There's a little bit in there about Baroness, but mostly it's just about painting and whatnot, and I think it's wicked. Remember to subscribe, tell your friends, spread the love. That would be great. Hit me up, let me know any feedback at Swim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. Peace out.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.